Side 2, The Sapphire Rose, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 37. Then Sophronia began to murmur in Styric, gesturing with her fingers as she did so. The column of smoke that rose from inside the walls was very convincing, thick, oily black, and boiling dreadfully.
"Hold my horse,"
Talon said to Sparhawk, slipping down from his saddle. He ran out to the edge of the bushes and began to shriek, "Fire!" at the top of his lungs. The so-called workmen gaped at him stupidly for a moment, then turned to stare in consternation at the city.
"You always have to yell fire," Talon explained when he returned. "It gets people to thinking in the right direction."
Then Curic galloped up to the spies outside the gate of the chapter house.
"You men," he barked, "there's a house on fire in Goat Lane. Get in there and help put the fire out before the whole city starts to burn."
"But, sir,"
one of the workmen objected,
"we were ordered to stay here and keep an eye on the Pandions."
"Do you have anything you value inside the city walls?" Curic asked him bluntly. "If that fire gets away from us, you can stand here and keep an eye on it while it burns. Now move, all of you. I'm going up to that fortress to see if I can persuade the Pandions to lend a hand."
The workmen looked at him, then dropped their tools and ran toward the illusory conflagration as Curic rode on toward the drawbridge of the chapter house.
"Slick," Sparhawk complimented Talon.
"Thieves do it all the time."
The boy shrugged.
"We have to use real fire, though. People run outside to gawk at fires. That provides an excellent opportunity to look around inside their houses for things of value."
He looked toward the city gate.
"Our friends seem to be out of sight. Why don't we ride on before they come back?"
Two Pandion knights in black armor rode gravely out to meet them as they reached the drawbridge.
"Is that a fire in the city, Sparhawk?"
one of them asked in some alarm.
"Not really," Sparhawk replied. "Sophronia's entertaining the church soldiers."
The other knight grinned at Sophronia. Then he straightened.
"Who art thou who entreateth entry into the house of the soldiers of God?"
he began the ritual.
"We don't have time for that, brother," Sparhawk told him. "We'll go through it twice next time. Who's in charge now?"
"Lord Vanion."
That was surprising. Preceptor Vanion had been much involved in the campaign in Arsham when last Sparhawk had heard of him.
"Do you have any idea where I might locate him?"
"He's in his tower, Sparhawk," the second knight advised.
Sparhawk grunted.
"How many knights are here right now, brother?"
"About 100.
"Good. I may need them."
Sparhawk nudged Farron with his heels. The big roan turned his head to look at his master with some surprise.
"We're busy, Farron," Sparhawk explained to his horse. "We'll go through the ritual some other time."
Farron's expression was disapproving as he started across the drawbridge.
"Sir Sparhawk!"
A ringing voice came from the stable door. It was the novice Bayrett, a rangy, raw-boned young man whose face was split with a broad grin.
"Shout a little louder, Bayrett," Curic said reprovingly. "Maybe they'll be able to hear you in Kyrillos."
"Sorry, Curic,"
Bayrett apologized, looking abashed.
"Get some other novices to look after our horses and come with us," Sparhawk told the young man. "We have things to do, and we have to talk with Vanion."
"Yes, Sir Sparhawk."
Bayrett ran back into the stable.
"He's such a nice boy,"
Sophronia smiled.
"He might work out," Curic said grudgingly.
"Sparhawk?"
a hooded Pandion said with some surprise as they entered the arched door leading into the chapter house. The knight pushed back his hood.
It was Sir Perrain, the Pandion who had posed as a cattle buyer in Dabur.
Perrain spoke with a slight accent.
"What are you doing back in Simara, Perrain?"
Sparhawk asked, clasping his brother knight's hand.
"We all thought you'd taken root in Dabur."
Perrain seemed to recover from his surprise.
"Ah," he began, "once Sir Asham died, there wasn't much reason for me to remain in Dabur.
But what are you doing here?
We'd heard that King Worgen was pursuing you all over Western Eosia."
"Pursuing isn't catching, Perrain," Sparhawk grinned. "We can talk later. Right now, my friends and I have to talk with Vanion."
"Of course."
Perrain bowed slightly to Sophronia and walked out into the courtyard.
They went up the stairs to the south tower where Vanion's study was located. The preceptor of the Pandion Order wore a white styric robe, and his face had aged even more in the short time since Sparhawk had last seen him. The others were also there, Euleth, Tinian, Bavier, and Calton. Their presence seemed somehow to make the room shrink. These were very large men, not only in sheer physical size, but also in terms of their towering reputations. The room seemed somehow full of bulky shoulders. As was customary among church knights when inside their chapter houses, they all wore monk's robes over their mail shirts.
"Finally," Calton said, letting out an explosive breath. "Sparhawk, why didn't you get word to us to let us know how you were?"
"Messengers are a little hard to find in troll country, Calton."
"Any luck?" Euleth asked eagerly.
Euleth was a huge, blonde-braided Thalesian, and Beliom had a special meaning for him. Sparhawk looked quickly at Sophronia, silently asking permission.
"All right," she said, "but only for a minute."
Sparhawk reached down inside his tunic and drew out the canvas pouch in which he carried Beliom. He pulled open the drawstring, lifted out the most precious object in the world, and placed it on the table Vanion used for a writing desk. Even as he did so, there came again that faint flicker of darkness somewhere off in a dim corner. The hound of darkness his nightmare had conjured up in the mountains of Thalesia followed him still, and the shadow seemed larger and darker now, as if each re-emergence of Beliom somehow increased its size and its brooding menace.
"Do not look too deeply into those petals, gentlemen," Sophronia warned. "Beliom can capture your souls if you look at it too long."
"God," Calton breathed, "look at that thing."
Each glowing petal of the sapphire rose was so perfect that one could almost see dew clinging to it. From deep within the jewel emanated a blue light and an almost overpowering command to look upon it and observe its perfection. "O God," Bavier prayed fervently, "defend us from the seduction of this stone." Bavier was a Cyrenic knight and an Arshan. Sometimes Sparhawk felt that he was excessively pious. This, however, was not one of those times. If even half of what he had already sensed was true, Sparhawk knew that Bavier's fear of Beliom was well placed. Euleth, the huge Thalesian, was muttering in troll.
"Not kill Beliom, Blue Rose," he said. "Church knights not enemies to Beliom. Church knights protect Beliom from Azash. Help make what is wrong right again, Blue Rose. I am Euleth from Thalesia. If Beliom have anger, send anger against Euleth."
Sparhawk straightened.
"No," he said firmly in the hideous troll tongue. "I am Sparhawk from Elenia. I am he who killed Gwerig Trolldwarf. I am he who brings Beliom Blue Rose to this place to heal my queen. If Beliom Blue Rose do this and still have anger, send anger against Sparhawk from Elenia and not against Euleth from Thalesia." "You fool!" Euleth exploded. "Have you got any idea of what that thing can do to you? Wouldn't it do the same sort of things to you?"
"Gentlemen, please," Sophronia said wearily, "stop this nonsense at once."
She looked at the glowing rose on the table.
"Listen to me, Beliom Blue Rose," she said firmly,
not even bothering to speak in the language of the trolls.
"Sparhawk from Elenia has the rings. Beliom Blue Rose must acknowledge his authority and obey him."
The jewel darkened briefly, and then the deep blue light returned.
"Good," she said. "I will guide Beliom Blue Rose in what must be done, and Sparhawk from Elenia will command it. Blue Rose must obey."
The jewel flickered, and then the light returned.
"Put it away now, Sparhawk."
Sparhawk put the rose back into its pouch and slipped it back under his tunic.
"Where's Flute?" Bayret asked, looking around.
"That, my young friend, is a very, very long story," Sparhawk told him.
"Not dead?" Sir Tinian asked in a shocked tone. "Surely not dead?"
"No," Sparhawk told him. "That would be impossible. Flute is immortal."
"No human is immortal, Sparhawk," Bavier
protested in a shocked voice.
"Exactly,"
Sparhawk replied.
"Flute's not human. She's the styric child goddess Afrael." Heresy! Bavior gasped.
You wouldn't think so if you'd been in Gwerig's cave, Sir Bavior, Curic told him. I saw her rise from a bottomless abyss with my own eyes.
A spell, perhaps?
But Bavior did not seem quite so sure of himself now. No, Bavior, Sophronia said. No spell could have accomplished what she did in that cave. She was and is Aphrael.
Before we get involved in a theological dispute here, I need some information, Sparhawk said. How did you all get away from Worgen? And what's happening in the city?
Worgen wasn't really a problem, Vanion told him. We came through Simara on our way south, and things went more or less the way we'd planned them at Assier. We threw Lycaeus into the dungeon, put the Earl of Lenda in charge, and persuaded the army and the church soldiers here in Simara to march south with us.
How did you manage that? Sparhawk asked with some surprise.
Banion's a very good persuader, Colton grinned. Most of the generals were loyal to Primate Annius, but when they tried to object, Vanion invoked the church law the Earl of Lenda mentioned back at Assier and took command of the army. The generals still objected until he marched them all down to the courtyard. After Euluth beheaded a few of them, most of the rest decided to change sides.
Oh, Vanion, Sophronia said in a tone of profound disappointment.
I was a bit pressed for time, little mother, he apologized. Worgen was in a hurry to get started. He wanted to butcher the entire Elanian officer corps, but I talked him out of that. Anyway, we joined with King Soros of Pelosia at the border and marched down into Arsham. The Rendors turned tail and ran when they saw us coming. Worgen intends to chase them down, but I think that's just for his personal entertainment. The other preceptors and I managed to convince him that our presence in Kyrelos during the election of the new archprelate was vital. So he let each of us take 100 knights.
That was generous of him, Sparhawk said sardonically. Where are the knights from the other orders?
They are camped outside Deimos. Dolmant doesn't want us to move into Kyrelos until the situation there solidifies.
If Lenda's in charge at the palace, why are there church soldiers on the walls of the city?
Annius found out what we'd done here, of course. There are members of the hierocracy who are loyal to him, and they all have their own troops. He borrowed some of those men and sent them here. They freed Lycaeus and imprisoned the Earl of Lenda. They control the city at the moment.
We ought to do something about that.
Vanion nodded.
We were on our way to Deimos with the other orders when we chanced to find out what was happening here. The other orders went on to Deimos to be in a position to move on Kyrelos, and we came here to Simara. We only arrived late last night. The knights were all eager to go into the city as soon as we got here, but we've been campaigning hard and they're all tired. I want them to be a little better rested before we correct things inside the walls.
Are we likely to have any problems?
I doubt it. Those church soldiers aren't Annius men. They're on loan from the other patriarchs, and their loyalties are a little vague. I think a show of force is probably about all it's going to take to make them capitulate.
Are the remaining 6 knights who were involved in the spell in the throne room among your 100? Sophronia asked him.
Yes, Vanion replied a little wanly. We're all here. He looked at the Pandion sword she was carrying.
Do you want to give me that? He asked.
No, she said firmly. You're carrying enough already. It isn't going to be much longer, anyway.
You're going to reverse the spell? Tinian asked.
Before you use Belium to cure the queen, I mean.
We have to, she told him. Belium has to touch her skin in order to cure her.
Colton went to the window. It's late afternoon now, he said. If we're going to do this today, we'd better get started.
Let's wait until morning, Vanion decided. If the soldiers try to resist, it might take a while to subdue them, and I don't want any of those people slipping away in the dark to warn Annius until we've had time to get reinforcements here.
How many soldiers are at the palace? Sparhawk asked.
My spies report a couple 100, Vanion replied. Hardly enough to cause us any problems.
We're going to have to come up with a way to seal the city for a few days, if we don't want to see a relief column wearing red tunics coming up the river, Euluth said.
I can take care of that, Talon told him. I'll slip into town just before dark and go talk to Platamy. He'll seal the gates for us.
Can he be trusted? Vanion asked.
Platamy? Of course not. But I think he'll do that much for us.
He hates Annius.
That's it, then, Colton said gaily. We can move out at dawn and have everything tidied up by lunchtime.
Don't bother to set a place at the table for the bastard Lycaeus,
Euroth said bleakly, testing the edge of his axe with his thumb.
I don't think he's going to have much of an appetite.
Chapter 3 Curic woke Sparhawk early the following morning and helped him into his formal black armor. Then, carrying his sword belt and plumed helmet, Sparhawk went to Vanion's study to await the dawn and the arrival of the others. This was the day. He had striven toward this day for half a year and more. Today he would look full into the eyes of his queen, salute her, and swear his oath of fealty. A terrible impatience welled up in him. He wanted to get on with it, and he swore at the sluggard sun for its leisurely rising.
And then, Annius, he almost purred, you and Martell are going to become no more than footnotes to history.
Did you get hit on the head when you had that fight with Gwerig?
It was Colton, who was also wearing his formal black armor, and who entered with his helmet under his arm.
Not really, Sparhawk replied.
Why?
You're talking to yourself. Most people don't do that, you know.
You're wrong, Colton. Almost everybody does it. Most of the time, though, it involves rewriting past conversations, or planning ones yet to come.
Which were you doing just now?
Neither.
I was sort of warning Annius and Martell what to expect.
They couldn't hear you, you know.
Maybe not. But giving them some kind of warning is the knightly thing to do. At least I'll know I said it, even if they don't.
I don't think I'll bother with that when I go after Attis.
Colton grinned.
Do you have any idea of how long it would take to pound a thought into Attis?
Oh, who gets to kill Kroger, by the way?
Let's give him to somebody who does something nice for us.
Sounds fair.
Colton paused, and his face grew serious.
Is it going to work, Sparhawk? Will Belium really cure Alana? Or have we just been fooling ourselves?
I think it's going to work. We have to believe that it will.
Belium's very, very powerful.
Have you ever used it at all?
Once. I collapsed a ridgeline in the mountains of Thalesia with it.
Why?
It needed to be done.
Don't think about Belium, Colton. It's very dangerous to do that.
Colton looked skeptical.
Are you going to let Euloth shorten Lycaeus a bit when we get to the palace?
Euloth really enjoys doing that to people.
Or I could hang the bastard if you'd prefer.
I don't know, Sparhawk said. Maybe we should wait and let Alana make the decision.
Why bother her with it? She's probably going to be a little weak after all this, and as her champion, you really ought to try to spare her any exertion.
Colton squinted at Sparhawk.
Don't take this wrong, he said, but Alana is a woman after all, and women are notoriously tender-hearted. If we leave it up to her, she may not let us kill him at all. I'd rather have him safely dead before she wakes up. We'll apologize to her, of course, but it's very hard to unkill somebody, no matter how sorry you are.
You're a barbarian, Colton.
Me? Oh, by the way, Vanian's got our brothers putting on their armor. We should all be ready by the time the sun's up and the people in the city open the gates.
Colton frowned.
That might present a problem, though. There'll be church soldiers at the gates, and they may try to slam them shut in our faces when they see us coming.
That's what battering rams are for.
Sparhawk shrugged.
The queen might get a little cross with you if she finds out that you've been knocking down the gates of her capital city.
We'll make the church soldiers repair them.
It's honest work, right enough. And that's something church soldiers know very little about. I'd suggest you take a hard look at that stretch of cobblestones outside our gates before you make any final decisions, though. Church soldiers aren't very handy with tools.
The big blonde man sank into a chair, his armor creaking.
It's taken us a long time, Sparhawk. But it's almost over now, isn't it?
Very nearly, Sparhawk agreed. And once Alana's well again, we can go looking for Martell.
Colton's eyes brightened.
And Annius, he added. I think we should hang him from the arch of the main gate of Kyrillos.
He's a church primate, Colton, Sparhawk said in a pained voice.
You can't do that to him. We can apologize to him later.
How exactly do you propose to do that?
I'll work something out, Calton replied in an offhand manner.
Maybe we could call it a mistake or something.
The sun had risen by the time they gathered in the courtyard. Vanion, looking pale and drawn, struggled down the stairs with a large case.
The swords, he explained tersely to Sparhawk. Sifrania says we'll need them when we get to the throne room.
Can't somebody else carry them for you? Calton asked him.
No, they're my burden. As soon as Sifrania comes down, we'll get started.
The small Styric woman seemed very calm, even remote, when she emerged from the chapter house with Sir Garrod's sword in her hands and with Talon close behind her.
Are you all right? Sparhawk asked her.
I've been preparing myself for the ritual in the throne room, she replied.
There might be some fighting, Curic said. Is it really a good idea for us to bring Talon along with us?
I can protect him, she said, and his presence is necessary. There are reasons, but I don't think you'd understand them.
Let's mount up and go, Vanion said.
There was a great deal of clinking as the 100 black-armored Pandion knights climbed into their saddles. Sparhawk took his customary place at Vanion's side, with Calton, Bavier, Tinian, and Euleth close behind them, and the column of Pandions strung out to the rear. They crossed the drawbridge at a trot, and bore down on the startled troop of church soldiers outside the gate. At a curt signal from Vanion, a score of Pandions swung out from the column and encircled the so-called workmen.
Hold them here until the rest of us take the city gates, Vanion instructed. Then bring them into the city and rejoin us.
Yes, my lord, Sir Perrin replied.
All right, gentlemen, Vanion said then. I think a gallop is in order at this point. Let's not give the soldiers in the city too much time to prepare for our arrival.
They thundered across the rather short distance between the chapter house and the east gate of Simera. Despite Calton's concern about the possibility of the gates being closed to them, the soldiers there were too surprised to react in time.
Sir Knights, an officer protested shrilly. You can't enter the city without the Prince Regent's authorization.
With your permission, Lord Vanion?
Tinian asked politely.
Of course, Sir Tinian, Vanion consented. We have pressing matters to attend to, and we really don't have time for idle chit-chat here.
Tinian moved his horse forward. The knight from Deira was deceptively moon-faced. He had the sort of countenance one would normally associate with good humor and a generally happy approach to life. His armor, however, concealed a massively developed upper torso and powerful arms and shoulders. He drew his sword.
My friend, he said pleasantly to the officer, would you be so good as to step aside so that we may proceed? I'm sure none of us wants any unpleasantness here.
His tone was civil, almost conversational.
Many of the church soldiers, long accustomed to having things their own way in Simera, were not really prepared to have anyone question their authority. It was the officer's misfortune to be one of those soldiers.
I must forbid your entry into the city without specific authorization from the Prince Regent, he declared stubbornly.
That's your final word, then? Tinian asked in a regretful tone.
It is.
It's your decision, friend, Tinian said.
Then he raised up in his stirrups and swung a vast overhand blow with his sword. Since the officer could not believe that anyone would actually defy him, he made no move to protect himself. His expression was one of amazement as Tinian's heavy, broad-bladed sword struck the angle between his neck and shoulder and sheared diagonally down into his body. Blood fountained up from the dreadful wound, and the suddenly limp body hung from Tinian's sword, held there by the crushed-in edges of the great rent in the officer's steel breastplate. Tinian leaned back in his saddle, removed his foot from his stirrup, and kicked the body off his sword blade.
I did ask him to move out of our way, Lord Vanion, he explained.
Since he chose not to, what just happened is entirely his responsibility, wouldn't you say?
It was indeed, Sir Tinian, Vanion agreed. I see no blame accruing to you in this matter. You were the very soul of courtesy.
Let's proceed, then, Euleth said.
He slipped his war axe from its sling at the side of his saddle.
All right, he said to the wide-eyed church soldiers. Who's next?
The soldiers fled.
The knights who had been guarding the workmen came up at a trot, herding their prisoners ahead of them. Vanion left 10 of them to hold the gates, and the column moved on into the city. The citizens of Cimera were fully aware of the situation at the palace, and when they saw a column of bleak-faced Pandion knights in their ominous black armor riding through the cobbled streets, they knew immediately that a confrontation was imminent. Doors slammed up and down the street, and shutters were hastily closed from the inside. The knights rode on through now deserted streets. There was a sudden spiteful buzz from behind them, and a heavy clang. Sparhawk half-wheeled Farron. "You really ought to watch your back, Sparhawk," Calton told him. "That was a crossbow bolt, and it would have taken you right between the shoulder blades. You owe me what it's going to cost to have my shield re-enameled." "I owe you more than that, Calton," Sparhawk said gratefully. "Strange," Tinian said. "The crossbow's a Lamarck weapon. Not many church soldiers carry them."
"Maybe it was something personal," Euleth grunted. "Have you offended any Lamarcks lately, Sparhawk?"
"Not that I know of." "There won't be much point in extended conversation when we get to the palace," Vanion said. "I'll order the soldiers to throw down their arms when we arrive."
"Do you think they'll do it?" Calton asked.
Vanion grinned mirthlessly. "Probably not, at least not without several object lessons. When we get there, Sparhawk, I want you to take your friends here and secure the door to the palace. I don't think we'll want to chase church soldiers up and down the halls."
"Right," Sparhawk agreed.
The church soldiers, warned by the men who had fled from the city gates, had formed up in the palace courtyard, and the largely ornamental palace gates were closed.
"Bring up the ram," Vanion called.
A dozen Pandions rode forward with a heavy log carried in rope slings attached to their saddles. It took them perhaps 5 minutes to batter down the gates, and then the church knights streamed into the courtyard.
"Throw down your weapons," Vanion shouted to the confused soldiers in the yard.
Sparhawk led his friends around the perimeter of the courtyard to the large doors that gave entry into the palace. There they dismounted and climbed the stairs to confront the dozen soldiers on guard in front of the door. The officer in charge drew his sword.
"No one may enter," he barked.
"Get out of my way, neighbor," Sparhawk said in his deadly quiet voice.
"I don't take orders from—"
the officer began. Then his eyes glazed, as there was a sudden sound like that a melon might make when dropped on a stone floor, as Keurig deftly brained him with his spiked chain mace. The officer dropped, twitching.
"That's something new," Sir Tinian said to Sir Euleth. "I never saw a man with brains coming out of his ears before."
"Keurig's very good with that mace," Euleth agreed.
"Any questions?" Sparhawk asked the other soldiers ominously. They stared at him.
"I believe you were told to drop your weapons," Calton told them.
They hurriedly shed their arms.
"We're relieving you here, neighbors," Sparhawk informed them. "You may join your friends out there in the yard."
They quickly went down the stairs. The mounted Pandions were slowly advancing on the church soldiers standing in the courtyard. There was some sporadic resistance from the more fanatic of the soldiers, and the Pandion knights provided a sizable number of those object lessons their preceptor had mentioned. The center of the courtyard soon flowed with blood, and it was littered with unattached heads, arms, and a few legs. More and more of the soldiers saw the direction the fight was going, threw away their weapons, and raised their hands in surrender. There was one stubborn pocket of resistance, but the knights pushed the struggling soldiers up against one wall and slaughtered them. Vanion looked around the yard. "Herd the survivors into the stables," he ordered, "and post a few guards." Then he dismounted and walked back to the shattered gate. "It's all over, little mother," he called to Sophrenia, who had waited outside with Talon and Bayret. "It's safe to come in now." Sophrenia rode her white palfrey into the courtyard, shielding her eyes with one hand. Talon, however, looked around with bright, vicious eyes.
"Let's get rid of this," Euleth said to Keurig, bending to pick up the shoulders of the dead officer.
The two of them carried the body off to one side, and Tinian thoughtfully scraped the puddle of brains off the top step with one foot.
"Do you people always chop your enemies to pieces like this?"
Callan asked Sparhawk as he dismounted and went over to help Sophronia down from her horse. Sparhawk shrugged. Vanion wanted the soldiers to see what would happen to them if they offered any more resistance. Dismemberment is usually quite convincing.
Must you?
Sophronia shuddered. You'd better let us go in first, little mother, Sparhawk said as Vanion joined them with 20 knights. There may be soldiers hiding in there. As it turned out, there were a few, but Vanion's knights efficiently flushed them from their hiding places and took them to the main door and gave them pointed instructions to join their comrades in the stables. The doors to the council chamber were unguarded, and Sparhawk opened the door and held it for Vanion. Lycaeus was cowering, slack-lipped and trembling, behind the council table with a fat man in red, and Baron Harperin was desperately yanking on one of the bell-pulls.
"You can't come in here,"
Harperin said shrilly to Vanion in his high-pitched, effeminate voice.
"I command you to leave at once on the authority of King Lycaeus."
Vanion looked at him coldly. Sparhawk knew that Vanion bore a towering contempt for the disgusting pederast. "This man irritates me," he said in a flat voice, pointing at Harperin. "Will someone please do something about him?" Ulith strode around the table, his war axe in his hands.
"You wouldn't dare!"
Harperin squealed, cringing back and still yanking futilely at the bell pull.
"I'm a member of the Royal Council. You wouldn't dare do anything to me."
Ulith did, in fact, dare. Harperin's head bounced once and then rolled across the carpet to come to rest near the window. His mouth was agape and his eyes were still bulging in horror.
"Was that more or less what you had in mind, Lord Vanion?" the big Thalesian asked politely.
"Approximately, yes. Thank you, Sir Ulith."
"How about these other two?"
Ulith pointed his axe at Lycaeus and the fat man.
Not just yet, Sir Ulith."
The Pandion preceptor approached the council table, carrying the case containing the swords of the knights who had fallen. "Now, Lycaeus, where is the Earl of Lenda?" he demanded. Lycaeus gaped at him.
"Sir Ulith," Vanion said in a tone like ice.
Ulith grimly lifted his blood-stained axe.
"No!"
Lycaeus screamed.
"Lenda's confined down in the cellars. We didn't hurt him at all, Lord Vanion. I swear to you that he's..."
"Take Lycaeus and this other one down to the dungeon," Vanion ordered a pair of his knights. "Release the Earl of Lenda and replace him in the cell with these. Then bring Lenda here."
"If I may, my lord," Sparhawk asked.
"Of course."
"Lycaeus the bastard," Sparhawk said formally. "As Queen's champion, it is my distinct pleasure to place you under arrest on the charge of high treason. The penalty is rather well known. We'll attend to that just as soon as it's convenient. Thinking about it might give you something to occupy the long, tedious hours of your confinement."
"I could save you a great deal of time and expense, Sparhawk,"
Ulith offered helpfully, hefting his axe again. Sparhawk pretended to consider it.
"No," he said regretfully. "Lycaeus has run roughshod over the people of Cimera. I think they're entitled to the spectacle of a nice, messy, public execution."
Lycaeus was actually blubbering in terror as Sir Perrine and another knight dragged him past the wide-eyed head of Baron Harperin and out of the room.
"You're a hard and ruthless man, Sparhawk," Xavier noted.
"I know."
Sparhawk looked at Vanion.
"We'll have to wait for Lenda," he said. "He's got the key to the throne room. I don't want Elana to wake up and find out that we've chopped her door down."
Vanion nodded. "I need him for something anyway," he said. He put the sword case on the council table and sat down in one of the chairs. "Oh, by the way," he said, "cover Harperin up before Sophronia gets here. Things like that distress her." It was yet another clue, Sparhawk thought, that Vanion's concern for Sophronia went far beyond what was customary. Ulith went to the window, jerked down one of the drapes, and turned back, pausing only to kick Harperin's head back over beside the pederast's body. Then he covered the remains with the drape.
"A whole generation of little boys will sleep more securely now that Harperin's no longer with us," Colton observed lightly,
"and they'll probably mention Ulith in their prayers every night."
"I'll take all the blessings I can get," Ulith shrugged.
Sophrania entered with Talon and Bayret in tow. She looked around.
"I'm pleasantly surprised," she noted. "I was more or less expecting additional carnage."
Then her eyes narrowed. She pointed at the draped body lying by the wall.
"What's that?" she demanded. "The late Baron Harperin," Colton told her.
"He left us rather suddenly."
"Did you do that, Sparhawk?" she accused.
"Me?
I know you all too well, Sparhawk."
"Actually, Sophrania, it was me," Euleth drawled. "I'm very sorry if it bothers you, but then I'm a Thalesian. We're widely reputed to be barbarians." He shrugged. "One is more or less obliged to uphold the reputation of his homeland, wouldn't you say?" She refused to answer that. She looked around at the faces of the other Pandions in the room.
"Good," she said. "We're all here. Open that case, Vanion."
Vanion opened the sword case.
"Sir Knights,"
Sophrania addressed the Pandions in the room as she laid Sir Garrod's sword on the table beside the case.
"Some months ago, 12 of you joined with me in casting the enchantment that has sustained the life of Queen Alana. 6 of your brave companions have gone into the House of the Dead since then. Their swords, however, must be present when we undo the enchantment that we may cure the Queen. Thus each of you who was there must carry the sword of one of your fallen brothers as well as your own. I will work the spell that will make it possible for you to take up those swords. We will then proceed to the throne room, where the swords of the fallen will be taken from you."
Vanion looked startled.
"Taken? By whom?"
"Their original owners."
"You're going to summon ghosts into the throne room?" he asked in astonishment.
"They will come unsummoned. Their oaths ensure that. As before, you'll encircle the throne with your swords extended. I'll undo the spell, and the crystal will disappear. The rest is up to Sparhawk. And Beliom."
"What exactly am I supposed to do?" Sparhawk asked her.
"I'll tell you at the proper time," she replied. "I don't want you to do anything prematurely."
Sir Perrine escorted the aged Earl of Lenda into the council chamber.
"How was the dungeon, my Lord of Lenda?"
Vanion asked lightly.
"Damp, Lord Vanion," Lenda replied. "Also dark and very smelly. You know how dungeons are."
"No," Vanion laughed. "Not really. It's an experience I'd prefer to forego."
He looked at the old courtier's lined face.
"Are you all right, Lenda?" he asked. "You look very tired."
"Old men always look very tired, Vanion."
Lenda smiled gently.
"And I'm older than most."
He straightened his thin old shoulders.
"Being thrown into the dungeon from time to time is an occupational hazard for those in public service. You get used to it. I've been in worse."
"I'm sure Lycaeus and that fat fellow will enjoy the dungeon, my lord," Colton said lightly.
"I doubt that, Sir Colton."
"We've made them aware of the fact that the end of their confinement will mark their entrance into another world. I'm sure they'll prefer the dungeon. Rats aren't all that bad."
"I didn't notice Baron Harperin," Lenda said. "Did he escape?"
"Only in a manner of speaking, my lord," Colton replied. "He was being offensive. You know how Harperin was. Sir Euleth gave him a lesson in courtesy, with his axe."
"This day is top filled with joyful surprises, then,"
Lenda chortled.
"My lord of Lenda," Vanion said rather formally, "we're going to the throne room now to restore the queen. I'd like to have you witness that restoration so that you can confirm her identity in case any doubts arise later. The commons are superstitious, and there are those who might want to circulate rumors to the effect that Alana is not who she appears to be."
"Very well, my lord Vanion," Lenda agreed. "But how do you plan to restore her?"
"You'll see." Sophrania smiled. She held out her hands over the swords and spoke at some length in Styric. The swords glowed briefly as she released the spell, and the knights who had been present during the encasement of the Queen of Elenia stepped to the table. She talked to them briefly in low tones, and then each of them took up one of the swords.
"Very well," she said. "Let us proceed to the throne room."
"This is all very mysterious,"
Lenda said to Sparhawk as they walked down the corridor toward the throne room.
"Have you ever seen real magic performed, my lord?" Sparhawk asked him.
"I don't believe in magic, Sparhawk."
"That may change shortly, Lenda." Sparhawk smiled. The old courtier produced the key from an inside pocket and unlocked the door to the throne room. Then they all followed Sophronia inside. The room was dark. During Lenda's confinement, the candles had been allowed to go out. Sparhawk nonetheless could still hear the measured drumbeat of his queen's heart echoing in the darkness. Keurig stepped back outside and brought in a torch.
"Fresh candles?" he asked Sophronia.
"Definitely," she replied. "Let's not awaken Alana to a dark room."
Keurig and Bayrit replaced the burned-out candle stubs with fresh tapers. Then Bayrit looked curiously at the young queen he had served so faithfully without ever having seen her. His eyes grew suddenly wide as he stared at her, and he seemed to catch his breath. His look was one of totally appropriate veneration, but there was, Sparhawk thought, perhaps a bit more to it than simple respect. Bayrit was about the same age as Alana, and she was very beautiful after all.
"That's much better," Sophronia said, looking around at the candle-lit throne room. "Sparhawk, come with me."
She led him to the dais upon which the throne stood. Alana sat as she had for all these months. She wore the crown of Elenia on her pale blonde head, and she was enfolded in her state robes. Her eyes were closed, and her face serene.
"Just a few more moments, my queen," Sparhawk murmured.
Strangely, his eyes filled with tears, and his heart was in his throat.
"Remove your gauntlets, Sparhawk," Sophronia told him. "You'll want the rings to touch Belion when you use it."
He took off his mailed gauntlets, then reached inside his surcoat, removed the canvas pouch, and untied the drawstring.
"All right, gentlemen," Sophronia said then to the surviving knights. "Take your places."
Vanion and the five other Pandions spaced themselves out around the throne, each of them holding his own sword and that of one of his fallen brothers. Sophronia stood beside Sparhawk and began to form the incantation in Styrek, her fingers weaving an accompaniment. The candles dimmed and flared almost in time to the sonorous spell. At some time during her incantation, the room became gradually filled with that familiar smell of death. Sparhawk tore his eyes from Elana's face to risk a quick look around the circle of knights. Where there had been six before, there were now 12. The filmy shapes of those who had fallen one by one in the preceding months had returned unbidden to take their swords one last time.
"Now, sir knights," Sophronia instructed the living and the dead alike, "point your swords at the throne."
And she began to speak a different incantation. The tip of each sword began to glow, and those incandescent points of light grew brighter and brighter, until they surrounded the throne with a ring of pure light. Sophronia raised her arm, spoke a single word, then brought the arm sharply down. The crystal encasement surrounding the throne wavered like water, and then it was gone. Elana's head sagged forward, and her body began to tremble violently. Her breathing was suddenly labored, and the heartbeat that still echoed through the room faltered. Sparhawk leaped up onto the dais to go to her aid.
"Not yet," Sophronia told him sharply. "But do as I say."
He stood helplessly over his stricken queen for a minute that seemed to last for an hour. Then Sophronia stepped forward and lifted Elana's chin with both her hands. The queen's gray eyes were wide and vacant, and her face was twisted grotesquely.
"Now, Sparhawk," Sophronia said, "take Belion in your hands and touch it to her heart. Be sure the rings are touching the stone. At the same time, command it to heal her."
He seized the sapphire rose in both hands. Then he gently touched the flower gem to Elana's breast.
"Heal my queen, Belion Blue Rose," he commanded in a loud voice. The enormous surge of power coming from the jewel between his hands sent Sparhawk to his knees. The candles flickered and dimmed as if some dark shadow had passed over the room. Was it something fleeing,
Or was it perhaps that shadow of dread that followed him and haunted all his dreams? Elana stiffened, and her slender body was slammed against the back of her throne. A hoarse gasp came from her throat. Then her wide-eyed stare was suddenly rational, and she gazed at Sparhawk in astonishment.
"It is done," Sophronia said in a trembling voice, and then she slumped weakly down on the dais. Elana drew in a deep, shuddering breath. "My knight," she cried out feebly, extending her arms to the black-armored Pandion kneeling before her. Though her voice was weak, it nonetheless was full and rich. A woman's voice now, and not the childish one Sparhawk remembered. "Oh, my Sparhawk, you have come back to me at last." She laid her trembling arms about his armored shoulders, inserted her face beneath his raised visor, and kissed him lingeringly. "Enough of that for now, children," Sophronia told them. "Sparhawk, carry her to her chambers." Sparhawk was very disturbed. Elana's kiss had been anything but childlike. He tucked Belliom away, removed his helmet, and tossed it to Colton. Then he gently picked up his queen. She put her pale arms about his shoulders and her cheek to his.
"Oh, I have found thee," she breathed, "and I love thee, and I will not let thee go."
Sparhawk recognized the passage she was quoting, and it seemed wildly inappropriate. He grew even more troubled. There was obviously a serious mistake here someplace. Chapter 4 Elana was going to be a problem, Sparhawk decided, as he removed his armor not long after he had presented himself to his queen the following morning. Though she had never been far from his thoughts during his exile, he found that he had to make a number of difficult adjustments. When he had left, their relative positions had been clearly defined. He was the adult, she was the child. That had changed now, and they were both treading the unfamiliar ground of the monarch and subject relationship. He had been told by Curic and others that the girl he had raised almost from babyhood had shown remarkable mettle during the few months before Aeneas had poisoned her. Hearing about it was one thing. Experiencing it was another. This is not to say that Elana was harsh or peremptory with him, for she was not. She felt, he thought and hoped, a genuine affection for him, and she did not give him direct commands so much as give the impression that she expected him to accede to her wishes. They were functioning in a gray area, and there were all sorts of opportunities for serious missteps on either side. Several recent incidents were perfect examples of that sort of thing. In the first place, her request that he sleep in a chamber adjoining hers was, he felt, highly inappropriate, even slightly scandalous. When he had tried to point that out, however, she had laughed at his fears. His armor, he reasoned, had provided some small defense against wagging tongues. Times were troubled, after all, and the Queen of Elania needed protection. As her champion, Sparhawk had the obligation, the right even, to stand guard over her. When he had presented himself to her that morning once again in full armor, however, she had wrinkled her nose and suggested that he change clothes immediately. He knew that would be a serious mistake. The Queen's champion in armor was one thing, and no one with a reasonable regard for his own health would be likely to make an issue of Sparhawk's proximity to the royal person. If he were dressed in doublet and hose, though, that would be quite another thing. The servants were bound to talk, and the gossip of palace servants had a way of spreading throughout the city. Now Sparhawk looked dubiously into the mirror. His doublet was silver-trimmed black velvet, and his hose were gray. The clothing bore some faint resemblance to a uniform, and the black half-boots he had chosen had a more military appearance than the pointed shoes currently in fashion at court. He rejected the slender rapier out of hand, and belted on his heavy broadsword instead. The effect was slightly ludicrous, but the presence of the heavier weapon quite clearly stated that Sparhawk was in the Queen's apartment on business. "That's absolutely absurd, Sparhawk," Elana laughed when he returned to the sitting room where she lay prettily propped up by pillows on a divan, a blue satin coverlet across her knees. "My Queen," he said coolly. "That broadsword, Sparhawk, it's completely out of place with those clothes.
Please take it off at once and wear the rapier I ordered provided for you.
If my appearance offends you, Your Majesty, I'll withdraw. The sword, however, stays where it is. I can't protect you with a knitting needle. Her gray eyes flashed.
You?
She began hotly. My decision, Elana. He cut across her objections. Your safety is my responsibility, and the steps I take to ensure it are not open to discussion. They exchanged a long, hard stare. This would not be the last time their wills would clash, Sparhawk was sure. Elana's eyes softened.
So stern and unbending, my champion, she said.
Where Your Majesty's safety is concerned, yes. He said it flatly. It was probably best to get that clearly understood right at the outset.
But why are we arguing, my knight?
She smiled whimsically, fluttering her eyelashes at him. Don't do that, Elana, he told her, automatically assuming the tutorial manner he had used when she was a little girl. You're the queen, not some coy chambermaid trying to get her own way. Don't ask or try to be charming. Command.
Would you take off the sword if I commanded you to, Sparhawk?
No, but the usual rules don't apply to me.
Who decided that?
I did. We can send for the Earl of Lenda if you'd like. He's well versed in the law, and he can give us his opinion on the matter.
But if he decides against you, you'll ignore him, won't you?
Yes.
That's not fair, Sparhawk.
I'm not trying to be fair, my queen.
Sparhawk, when we're alone like this, do you suppose we could dispense with the Your Majesties and my queens? I do have a name, after all, and you weren't afraid to use it when I was a child.
As you wish.
He shrugged. Say it, Sparhawk. Say Elana. It's not a hard name, and I'm sure you won't choke on it.
He smiled. All right, Elana. He gave up. After her defeat on the issue of the sword, she needed a victory of some kind to restore her dignity.
You're so much more handsome when you smile, my champion. You should try it more often.
She leaned back on her pillows, her face thoughtful. Her pale blonde hair had been carefully combed that morning, and she wore a few modest but quite expensive pieces of jewelry. Her cheeks were prettily rosy, which was in quite some contrast to her very fair skin.
What did you do in Rendor after the idiot Aldreus sent you into exile?
That's hardly the proper way to speak of your father, Elana.
He wasn't much of a father, Sparhawk, and his intellect wasn't exactly what you'd call towering. The efforts he expended entertaining his sister must have softened his brains.
Elana!
Don't be such a prude, Sparhawk. The whole palace knew about it. The whole city, probably.
Sparhawk decided that it was time to find a husband for his queen.
How did you find out so much about Princess Arissa? He asked her. She was sent to that cloister near Deimos before you were born.
Gossip lingers, Sparhawk, and Arissa was hardly what you'd call discreet. Sparhawk cast about for a way to change the subject. Although Elana seemed to be aware of the basic implications of what she was saying, he could not bring himself to give credence to the notion that she could be so worldly. Some part of his mind stubbornly clung to the notion that beneath her evident maturity, she was still the same innocent child he had left 10 years before.
Hold out your left hand, he told her. I have something for you.
The tone of their relationship was still indistinct. They both felt that keenly, and it made them uncomfortable. Sparhawk swung back and forth between a stiffly correct formality and an abrupt, almost military manner of command. Elana seemed to fluctuate, too, at one moment the coltish, knobby-kneed girl he had trained and molded, and in the next a full-fledged queen. At a somewhat deeper level, they were both extremely aware of the changes a short decade had brought to Elana. The process known as filling out had done some very significant things to the Queen of Elania. Since Sparhawk had not been present to grow gradually accustomed to them, they were thrust upon his awareness in full flower. He tried as best he could to avoid looking at her without giving offense. For her part, Elana seemed quite self-conscious about her recently acquired attributes. She seemed to waver between a desire to show them off, even to flaunt them, and an embarrassed wish to conceal them behind anything that lay at hand. It was a difficult time for them both. At this point, something should be clarified in Sparhawk's defense. Elana's almost overpowering femininity, coupled with her queenly manner and disconcerting candor, had distracted him, and the rings looked so much alike that he should be forgiven for taking his own off by mistake. He slipped it on her finger without giving any thought to the implications. Despite the similarity of the two rings, there were a few minuscule differences, and women are notoriously adept at recognizing such tiny variations. Elana gave the ruby ring he had just placed on her finger what appeared to be no more than a cursory glance. Then, with a squeal of delight, she threw her arms about his neck, nearly pulling him off balance in the process, and glued her lips to his. It is unfortunate, perhaps, that Vanion and the Earl of Lenda chose that moment to enter the room. The old Earl coughed politely, and Sparhawk, flushing to the roots of his hair, gently but firmly disengaged the Queen's arms from about his neck. The Earl of Lenda was smiling knowingly, and one of Vanion's eyebrows was curiously raised.
"Sorry to interrupt, my Queen," Lenda said diplomatically, "but since your recovery appears to be progressing so well, Lord Vanion and I thought it might be a suitable time to bring you up to date on certain matters of state."
"Of course, Lenda," she replied, brushing aside the implied question of just exactly what she and Sparhawk had been doing when the pair had entered the room. "There are some friends outside, Your Majesty," Vanion said. "They will be able to brief you on some events in greater detail than the Earl and I would be able to." "Then show them in by all means." Sparhawk stepped to a sideboard and poured himself a glass of water. His mouth was very dry for some reason. Vanion went outside for a moment and returned with Sparhawk's friends. "I believe you know Sophronia, Curic, and Sir Colton, Your Majesty," he said. He then introduced the others, judiciously omitting references to Talon's professional activities. "I'm so pleased to meet you all," Elana said graciously. "Now, before we begin, I have an announcement to make. Sir Sparhawk here has just proposed marriage to me. Wasn't that nice of him?"
Sparhawk had the glass to his lips at that point, and he went into an extended fit of choking.
"Why, whatever is the matter, dear?" Elana asked innocently. He pointed at his throat, making strangling noises.
When Sparhawk had somewhat regained his breath and a few shreds of his composure, the Earl of Lenda looked at his queen.
"I gather, then, that Your Majesty has accepted your champion's proposal?"
"Of course I have. That's what I was doing when you came in."
"Oh," the old man said, "I see."
Lenda was a consummate politician, and he was able to make statements like that without cracking a smile.
"Congratulations, my lord," Curic said gruffly, seizing Sparhawk's hand in a grip of iron and shaking it vigorously.
Colton was staring at Elana.
"Sparhawk?" he demanded incredulously.
"Isn't it odd how your closest friends never fully understand your greatness, my dear?" she said to Sparhawk. "Sir Colton," she said then, "your boyhood friend is the paramount knight in the world. Any woman would be honored to have him as her husband." She smiled smugly. "I'm the one who got him, however. All right, friends, please be seated, and tell me what's been happening to my kingdom while I've been ill. I trust you'll be brief. My betrothed and I have many plans to make."
Vanion had remained standing. He looked around at the others.
"If I leave out anything important, don't hesitate to step in and correct me," he said. He looked up at the ceiling. "Where to begin?" he mused. "You might start by telling me what it was that made me so ill, Lord Vanion," Elana suggested.
"You were poisoned, Your Majesty."
"What?"
"A very rare poison from Rendor, the same one that killed your father."
"Who was responsible?"
"In your father's case, it was his sister. In yours, it was the primate Aeneas. You knew that he's had his eyes on the throne of the archprelate in Kyrelos, didn't you?"
"Of course. I was doing what I could to stand in his way. If he reaches that throne, I think I'll convert to Ashandism, or maybe even become Styric. Would your god accept me, Sophronia?"
"Goddess, Your Majesty," Sophronia corrected. "I serve a goddess."
What an extraordinarily practical notion. Would I have to cut off my hair and sacrifice a few Aline children to her? Don't be absurd, Alana.
I'm only teasing, Sophronia, Alana laughed. But isn't that what the Aline Commons say about Styrix?
How did you find out about the poisonings, Lord Vanion?
Vanion quickly described Sparhawk's meeting with the ghost of King Aldreus, and the recovery of the ring that now mistakenly decorated the champion's hand. He then moved on, covering the de facto rulership of Annius and the elevation of the queen's cousin to the prince regency.
Lycaeus? She exclaimed at that point. Ridiculous, he can't even dress himself.
She frowned. If I was poisoned, and it was the same poison that killed my father, how is it that I'm still alive?
We used magic to sustain you, Queen Alana, Sophronia told her.
Vanion then spoke of Sparhawk's return from Rendor, and their growing conviction that Annius had poisoned her primarily to gain access to her treasury, in order to finance his campaign for the Archprelacy. Sparhawk took up the story at that point and told the young lady who had so recently netted him of the trip of the group of church knights and their companions to Kyrelos, then to Barata, and finally down into Rendor.
Who is Flute? Alana interrupted him at one point.
A Styrix foundling, he replied. At least we thought she was. She seemed to be about 6 years old, but she turned out to be much, much older than that. He continued his account, describing the trek across Rendor and the meeting with the physician in Dabur, who had finally told them that only magic could save the stricken queen. He then went on to tell her of the meeting with Martell.
I never liked him, she declared, making a face.
He's working for Annius now, Sparhawk told her, and he was in Rendor at the same time we were. There was a crazy old religious fanatic down there, Arashim, and he was the spiritual leader of the kingdom. Martell was trying to persuade him to invade the western Aline kingdoms as a diversion to give Annius a free hand during the election of the new archprelate. Sophronia and I went to Arashim's tent, and Martell was there.
Did you kill him?
Alana asked fiercely.
Sparhawk blinked. This was a side of her he had never seen.
The time wasn't exactly right, my queen, he apologized. I came up with a subterfuge instead, and persuaded Arashim not to invade until he received word from me. Martell was furious, but he couldn't do anything about it. He and I had a nice chat later, and he told me that he was the one who had found the poison and passed it on to Annius.
Would that stand up in a court of law, my lord? Alana asked the Earl of Lenda.
It would depend on the judge, your majesty, he replied.
We have nothing to worry about on that score, Lenda, she said grimly, because I'm going to be the judge. Also the jury.
Most irregular, your majesty, he murmured.
So was what they did to my father and me.
Go on with the story, Sparhawk.
We returned here to Simera and went to the chapter house. That's where I received the summons to go to the royal crypt under the cathedral to meet with your father's ghost. He told me a number of things. First, that it was your aunt who had poisoned him, and that it was Annius who'd poisoned you. He also told me that Lycaeus was the result of certain intimacies between Annius and Orisa.
Thank God, Alana exclaimed. I was half afraid that he was my father's bastard. It's bad enough to have to admit that he's my cousin, but a brother? Unthinkable.
Your father's ghost also told me that the only thing that could save your life was the Belium.
What's the Belium?
Sparhawk reached inside his doublet and pulled out the canvas pouch. He opened it and drew out the sapphire rose.
This is Belium, your majesty, he told her.
Once again he felt more than saw the annoying flicker of darkness at the very edge of his vision. He shook off the feeling as he held out the jewel.
How exquisite, she cried, reaching for it.
No, Sophronia said sharply. Don't touch it, Alana. It could destroy you.
Alana shrank back, her eyes wide.
But Sparhawk's touching it, she objected.
It knows him. It may know you as well, but let's not take any chances. We've all spent too much time and effort on you to waste it at this point.
Sparhawk tucked the jewel back into its pouch and put it away.
There's something else you should know, Alana, Sophronia continued.
Beliom is the most powerful and precious object in the world, and Azash wants it desperately. That's what was behind Otha's invasion of the West 500 years ago. Otha has Zamox and others here in the West trying to find the jewel. We must deny it to him at any cost.
Should we destroy it now? Sparhawk asked her bleakly.
The question cost him a great deal of effort to say for some reason.
Destroy it?
Elana cried.
But it's so beautiful.
It's all so evil, Sophrenia told her. She paused. Perhaps evil isn't the right term, though. It has no concept of the difference between good and evil. No, Sparhawk, let's keep it for a while longer, until we're certain Elana is past any danger of a relapse. Go on with the story. Try to be brief, your queen is still very weak.
I'll cut this short, then, he said.
He told his queen of their search of the battlefield at Lake Rundera, and of how they were finally able to locate Count Gossick. The queen listened intently, almost seeming to hold her breath as he recounted the events at Lake Veni. He quickly sketched in King Worgen's interference, though he did not use that exact word, and finally described the dreadful encounter in Gwerig's cave, and the revelation of Flute's real identity.
And that's where things stand right now, my queen, he concluded. King Worgen's battling the Rendors down in Arsham, Anius is in Kyrelos awaiting the death of Archprelate Clavonus, and you're back on your throne where you belong.
And also newly betrothed, she reminded him.
She was obviously not going to let him forget that.
She thought for a moment. And what have you done with Lycaeus? She asked intently.
He's back in the dungeon where he belongs, Your Majesty.
And Harperin and that other one?
The fat one's in the dungeon with Lycaeus. Harperin left us rather suddenly.
You let him escape?
Colton shook his head.
No, Your Majesty. He started screaming and trying to order us out of the council chamber.
Benion got bored with all the noise and had Euleth chop off his head.
How very appropriate. I want to see Lycaeus.
Shouldn't you rest? Sparhawk asked her.
Not until I have a few words with my cousin.
I'll fetch him, Euleth said. He turned and left the room.
My lord of Lenda, Elana said then, will you head up my royal council?
As your majesty wishes,
Lenda said with a low bow. And Lord Vanion, would you also serve when your other duties permit?
I'd be honored, Your Majesty.
As my consort and champion, Sparhawk will also have a seat at the council table. And I think Sophrenia as well.
I am Styrek, Elana, Sophrenia pointed out. Would it be wise to put a Styrek on your council, given the feelings of the Aline Commons about our race?
I'm going to put an end to that nonsense once and for all, Elana said firmly. Sparhawk, can you think of anyone else who might be useful on the council?
He thought about it, and suddenly an idea came to him. I know a man who isn't of noble birth, Your Majesty, but he's very clever, and he understands a great deal about a side of Simmera you probably don't even know exists.
Who is this man?
His name's Platamy. Talon burst out laughing.
Have you lost your mind, Sparhawk? He said. You're going to let Platamy into the same building with the treasury and the crown jewels?
Elana looked a bit puzzled. Is there some problem with this man? She asked.
Platamy's the biggest thief in Simmera, Talon told her. I know that for a fact because I used to work for him. He controls every thief and beggar in the city, also the swindlers, cutthroats, and whores.
Watch your language, young man, Curic barked.
I've heard the term before, Curic, Elana said calmly. I know what it means. Tell me, Sparhawk, what's your reasoning behind this suggestion?
As I said, Platamy's very clever, in some ways almost brilliant, and though it's a little odd, he's a patriot. He has a vast understanding of the society of Simmera, and he has ways of finding information that I can't even guess at. There's nothing that happens in Simmera, or in most of the rest of the world, for that matter, that he doesn't know about.
I'll interview him, Elana promised.
Then Euleth and Sir Perrain dragged Lycaeus into the room.
Lycaeus gaped at his cousin, his mouth open and his eyes bulging in astonishment.
How?
He began, then broke off, biting his lip.
"You didn't expect to see me alive, Lycaeus?" she asked in a deadly tone.
"I believe it's customary to kneel in the presence of your queen, Lycaeus," Ulith growled, kicking the bastard's feet out from under him. Lycaeus crashed to the floor and groveled there. The Earl of Lenda cleared his throat.
"Your Majesty," he said, "during the time of your illness, Prince Lycaeus insisted that he be addressed as Your Majesty. I'll have to consult the statutes, but I believe that constitutes high treason."
"That's what I arrested him for, at least," Sparhawk added. "That's good enough for me," Ulith said, raising his axe. "Say the word, Queen of Alania, and we'll have his head on a pole at the palace gate in a matter of minutes."
Lycaeus gaped at them in horror, and then began to cry, pleading for his life, while his cousin pretended to think it over. At least Sparhawk hoped that she was pretending. "Not here, Sir Ulith," she said a bit regretfully. "The carpeting, you understand."
"King Worgen wanted to hang him," Colton said.
He looked up.
"You've got a nice high ceiling in here, Your Majesty, and good stout beams. It won't take me but a moment to fetch a rope. We can have him dancing in the air in no time, and hanging's not nearly as messy as beheading."
Elana looked at Sparhawk.
"What do you think, dear? Should we hang my cousin?"
Sparhawk was profoundly shocked at the cold-blooded way she said it.
He has a great deal of information that could be useful to us, my queen," he said.
"That might be true," she said. "Tell me, Lycaeus, have you anything you'd like to share with us while I think this over?"
"I'll say anything you want, Elana," he blubbered.
Ulith cuffed him across the back of the head.
"Your Majesty," he prompted.
"What?"
"You call the queen Your Majesty," Ulith said, cuffing him again.
Your Majesty,"
Lycaeus stammered.
"There's something else, too, my queen," Sparhawk continued. "Lycaeus is Annia's son, you recall."
"How did you find out about that?"
Lycaeus exclaimed. Ulith cuffed him again.
"He wasn't talking to you. Speak when you're spoken to."
"As I was saying," Sparhawk went on, "Lycaeus is Annia's son, and he might be a useful bargaining chip in Kyrelos when we go there to try to keep Annius off the Archprelate's throne."
"Oh,"
Elana said petulantly.
"All right, I guess. But as soon as you're done with him, turn him over to Sir Ulith and Sir Colton. I'm sure they'll find a way to decide which one of them gets to send him on his way."
"Draw straws?" Colton asked Ulith.
"Or we could roll the dice," Ulith countered.
"My Lord Lenda," Elana said then, "why don't you and Lord Vanion take this wretch someplace and question him? I'm getting sick of the sight of him. Take Sir Colton, Sir Perrine, and Sir Ulith with you. Their presence might encourage him to be more forthcoming."
"Yes, Your Majesty," Lenda said, concealing a smile.
After Lycaeus had been dragged from the room, Sophrania looked the young queen full in the face.
"You weren't seriously considering that, were you, Elana?" she asked.
"Oh, of course not. Well, not too seriously, anyway. I just want Lycaeus to sweat a bit. I think I owe him that." She sighed wearily.
"I think I'd like to rest now," she said. "Sparhawk, do be a dear and carry me into bed."
"That's hardly proper, Elana," he said stiffly.
"Oh, bother proper. You may as well get used to thinking of me in beds at the same time, anyway."
"Elana!"
She laughed and held out her arms to him.
As Sparhawk bent and lifted his queen in his arms, he happened to catch a glimpse of Bayret's face. The young novice was giving him a look of undisguised hatred. There was going to be a problem here, Sparhawk saw. He decided to have a long talk with Bayret just as soon as the opportunity presented itself. He carried Elana into the other room and tucked her into a very large bed.
"You've changed a great deal, my queen," he said gravely. "You're not the same person I left 10 years ago." It was time to get that out into the open, so that they could both stop tiptoeing around it.
"You've noticed," she said archly.
"That's part of it right there," he told her, reverting to his professorial tone. "You're still only 18 years old, Elana. It's not becoming for you to assume the worldly airs of a woman of 35.
I strongly recommend a more innocent public pose. She squirmed around in bed until she was lying on her stomach with her head at the foot. She rested her chin in her hands, wide-eyed and ingenuous, her lashes fluttering and with one foot coyly kicking at her pillow.
"Like this?"
she asked.
"Stop that!"
"I'm just trying to please you, my betrothed. Was there anything else about me you'd like to change?"
"You've grown hard, child."
"Now it's your turn to stop something," she said firmly. "Don't call me child any more, Sparhawk. I stopped being a child the day Aldrea sent you to Rendor. I could be a child as long as you were here to protect me, but once you were gone I couldn't afford that any more." She sat up cross-legged on the bed. "My father's court was a very unfriendly place for me, Sparhawk," she told him gravely. "I was dressed up and displayed at court functions where I could watch Annius smirking. Any friends I had were immediately sent away or killed, so I was forced to entertain myself by eavesdropping on the empty-headed gossip of the chambermaids. As a group, chambermaids tend to be quite wanton. I drew up a chart once. You taught me to be methodical, you'll remember. You wouldn't believe what goes on below stairs. My chart indicated that one aggressive little minx had very nearly outstripped Orisa herself in her conquests. Her availability was almost legendary. If I sometimes seem worldly, wasn't that your term? You can blame it on the tutors who took up my education when you left. After a few years, since any friendship I displayed for the lords and ladies of the court was an immediate cause for their exile or worse, I came to rely on the servants. Servants expect you to give them orders, so I gave orders. It's a habit now. It worked out rather well for me, though. Nothing happens in the palace that the servants don't know about, and before long they were telling me everything. I was able to use that information to protect myself from my enemies, and everybody at court except Lenda was my enemy. It wasn't much of a childhood, Sparhawk, but it prepared me far better than empty hours spent rolling hoops or wasting affection on rag dolls or puppies. If I seem hard, it's because I grew up in hostile territory. It may take you some years to soften those sharp edges, but I'm sure I'll enjoy your efforts in that direction." She smiled winsomely, but there was still a kind of pained defensiveness in her gray eyes. "My poor Elana," he said, his heart in his throat. "Hardly poor, dear Sparhawk. I have you now, and that makes me the richest woman in the world." "We've got a problem, Elana," he said seriously. "I don't see any problems, not now." "I think you misunderstood when I gave you my ring by mistake." He regretted that instantly. Her eyes opened as wide as they might have had he slapped her in the face. "Please don't take what I just said wrong," he rushed on. "I'm just too old for you, that's all." "I don't care how old you are," she said defiantly. "You're mine, Sparhawk, and I'll never let you go." Her voice was so filled with steel that he almost shrank from her. "I was sort of obliged to point it out." He backstepped. He had to ease her past that dreadful moment of injury. "Duty, you understand." She stuck her tongue out at that. "All right, now that you've made your genuflection in duty's direction, we won't ever mention it again. When do you think we should have the wedding? Before or after you and Vanion go to Kyrellos and kill Annius? I'm rather in favor of getting right on with it, personally. I've heard all sorts of things about what goes on between a husband and wife when they're alone, and I'm really very, very curious." Sparhawk turned bright red at that. Chapter 5 "Is she asleep?" Vanion asked when Sparhawk emerged from Elana's bedroom. Sparhawk nodded. "Did Lycaeus tell you anything useful?" he asked. "A number of things, mostly verification of things we've already guessed," Vanion replied. The preceptor's face was troubled, and the strain of bearing the swords of the fallen knight still showed on him, although he looked more vigorous now. "Milord of Lenda," he said, "is the queen's apartment here secure? I'd rather not have some of the things Lycaeus told us become general knowledge." "The rooms are quite secure, milord," Lenda assured him, "and the presence of your knights in the corridors will probably discourage anyone who's afflicted with a burning curiosity." Calton and Euleth entered. and they both had vicious grins on their faces.
"Lycaeus is having a very bad day," Colton smirked. Eulith and I were recalling a number of lurid executions we'd seen in the past while we were escorting him back to his cell. He found the notion of being burned at the stake particularly distressing.
"And he almost fainted when we raised the possibility of racking him to death," Eulith chuckled. "Oh, by the way, we stopped by the palace gate on our way back here. The church soldiers we captured are repairing it." The towering Genidian knight set his axe in the corner. "Some of your pandions have been out in the streets, Lord Vanion. It seems that quite a number of the citizens of Simera have dropped out of sight." Vanion gave him a puzzled look.
"They seem a bit nervous for some reason," Colton explained. "Annius has been in control of the city for quite a while now, and some people, nobles and commons alike, always have their eyes open for the main chance. They went out of their way to accommodate the good primate. Their neighbors know who they are, though, and there have been a few incidents, I understand. When there's a sudden change of power, many people want to demonstrate their loyalty to the new regime in some visible way. There appear to have been several spontaneous hangings, and a fair number of houses are on fire. Eulith and I suggested to the knights that they put a stop to that, at least. Fires do tend to spread, you know."
"I just love politics, don't you?" Tinian grinned.
"Mob rule should always be suppressed," the Earl of Lenda said critically. "The mob is the enemy of any government."
"By the way," Colton said curiously to Sparhawk, "did you really propose to the Queen?"
"It's a misunderstanding."
"I was fairly sure it was. You've never struck me as the marrying kind. She's going to hold you to it anyway, though, isn't she?"
"I'm working on that. I wish you all the luck in the world, but quite frankly, I don't hold out much hope for you. I saw some of the looks she used to throw your way when she was a little girl. You're in for an interesting time, I think." Colton was grinning. "It's such a comfort to have friends."
"It's time you settled down anyway, Sparhawk. You're getting to be too old to be running around the world picking fights with people."
"You're as old as I am, Colton."
"I know, but that's different. Have you and Eulith decided who gets to dispose of Lycaeus yet?"
Tinian asked.
"We're still discussing it."
Colton gave the big Thalesian a suspicious look.
"Eulith's been trying to foist off a set of dice on me."
"Foist?" Eulith protested mildly.
"I saw one of those dice, my friend, and it had 4 sixes on it."
"That's a lot of sixes," Tinian noted.
"It is indeed," Colton sighed. "To be honest with you, though, I don't really think Elana's going to let us kill Lycaeus. He's such a pathetic lump that I don't think she'll have the heart."
"Oh, well," he added, "there's always Annius."
"And Martell," Sparhawk reminded him.
"Oh, yes. There's always Martell."
"Which way did he go after Worgen chased him away from Larium?" Sparhawk asked. "I always like to keep track of Martell. I wouldn't want him to get himself into any trouble."
"The last time we saw him, he was going east," Tinian said, shifting the shoulder plates of his heavy Daeran armor.
"East?"
Tinian nodded.
"We thought he'd go south to Eumanthem, but we found out later that he'd moved his fleet to Serenium, after the burning of Coombe, probably because Worgen has ships patrolling the Straits of Arsham. He's most likely back in Rendor by now."
Sparhawk grunted. He unhooked his sword belt, laid it on the table, and sat down.
"What did Lycaeus tell you?"
he asked Vanion.
"Quite a bit. It's fairly obvious that he didn't know anything Annius was doing, but surprisingly, he's managed to pick up a great deal of information. He's brighter than he looks."
"He'd almost have to be," Curic said.
"Talon," he said to his son, "don't do that."
"I was just looking, father,"
the boy protested.
"Don't. You might be tempted."
"Lycaeus told us that his mother and Annius have been lovers for years now," Vanion told them, "and it was Annius who suggested to Arissa that she attempt to seduce her brother. He'd come up with a rather obscure bit of church doctrine that appeared to permit a marriage between them."
"The church would never permit such an obscenity," Sebavia declared flatly.
"The church has done many things in her history that don't conform to contemporary morality, Bavia," Vanion said.
At one time she was very weak in Camoria, and there had been a tradition of incestuous marriages in the royal house of that kingdom. The church made allowances in order to continue her work there. Anyway, Annius reasoned that Aldreas was a weak king, and Orissa would be the real ruler of Alania if she married him. Then, since Annius more or less controlled Orissa, he'd be the one making the decisions. At first that seemed to be enough for him, but then his ambition began to run away with him. He started eyeing the archprelate's throne in Kyrillos. That was about 20 years ago, I gather. How did Lycaeus find out about it? Sparhawk asked him. He used to visit his mother in that cloister at Deimos, Banion replied. Orissa's reminiscences were rather wide-ranging, I understand, and she was quite candid with her son. That's revolting, Xavier said in a sick voice. Princess Orissa has a peculiar kind of morality, Colton told the young Artian. At any rate, Banion said, Sparhawk's father stepped in at that point. I knew him very well, and his morality was much more conventional. He was greatly offended by what Aldreas and Orissa were doing. Aldreas was afraid of him, so when he suggested a marriage to a Daeran princess instead, Aldreas rather reluctantly agreed. The rest is fairly well known. Orissa went into an absolute fury and ran off to that brothel down by the riverside. Sorry about that, Sophronia.
I've heard about it before, Vanion, she replied. Styrix are not nearly as unworldly as you Alines sometimes believe.
Anyway, Orissa stayed in the brothel for several weeks, and when she was finally apprehended, Aldreas had no choice but to confine her in that cloister.
That raises a question, Tinian said. Considering the amount of time she spent in that brothel and the number of customers she had, how can anyone be sure who Lycaeus' father was?
I was just coming to that, Vanion replied. She assured Lycaeus during one of his visits that she was pregnant to Annius before she went to the brothel. Aldreas married the Daeran princess, and she died giving birth to Queen Alana. Lycaeus was about 6 months old at the time, and Annius was doing his best to get Aldreas to legitimize him and make him his heir. That was too much even for Aldreas, and he flatly refused. It was about at that time that Sparhawk's father died, and Sparhawk here took his hereditary position as king's champion. Annius began to grow alarmed at Alana's progress after Sparhawk took charge of her education. By the time she was 8, he decided that he had to get her champion away from her, before he could make her so strong that Annius wouldn't be able to control her. That's when he persuaded Aldreas to send Sparhawk into exile in Rendor. And then he sent Martell to Cypria to kill him, and to make sure he'd never come back and complete Alana's education. But he was too late, wasn't he? Sparhawk smiled. Alana was already too strong for him.
How did you manage that, Sparhawk? Colton asked. You've never really been what you'd call a very inspiring teacher.
Love, Colton, Sophronia said quite softly. Alana's loved Sparhawk since she was very young, and she tried to do things the way he'd have wanted her to do them.
Tinian laughed.
You did it to yourself then, Sparhawk, he said.
Did what?
You made a woman of steel, and now she's going to force you to marry her, and she's strong enough to get away with it.
Tinian, Sparhawk said acidly, you talk too much.
The big Pandion was suddenly irritated, all the more so because he privately had to admit that Tinian was probably right.
The point here, though, is that none of this is really very new or surprising, Curic noted. It's certainly not enough to keep Lycaeus' head on his shoulders.
That came a little later, Vanion told him. Alana frightened him so much when she seemed on the verge of having him summarily executed that he was babbling at first. Anyway, after Annius had forced Aldreas to send Sparhawk into exile, the king began to change. He actually started to develop some backbone. It's a little hard sometimes to know why people do things.
Not really, Vanion, Sophronia disagreed. Aldreas was under the thumb of the primate, but in his heart he knew that what he was doing was wrong. Perhaps he felt that his champion might have been able to rescue his soul, but once Sparhawk was gone, Aldreas began to realize that he was totally alone. If his soul was going to be saved, he was going to have to do it himself.
End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.